Welcome to Unpacking the Digital Shelf, where we explore brand manufacturing in the digital age. Hey everyone, Peter Crosby, Executive Director of the Digital Shelf Institute. For CPGs, moving from the closed ecosystem of the brick and mortar world to the open marketplaces of the digital shelf has shifted the competitive landscape dramatically. Sam Gagliardi, who heads up the e-commerce practice at IRI, shared some big data on the path forward for CPGs in this week's episode. Rob Gonzalez and I dug into the data with him. So Sam, first I have to start out by asking you, what's your favorite digitally native brand that you've ever bought from? And what did you love about it?
My most favorite digitally native brand is Hello Toothpaste. And I think what drew me to it was that it was an alternative to what was offered in the stores. And that's what really captivated me. In fact, when we understand the motivation of why a lot of shoppers are migrating from the in-store to the online, across every single major CPG category, what we're seeing that the search for something new really is what driving a lot of the need to go from in-store to online. Shoppers just want to find new and different brands that they're not able to find in the in-store environment.
So how did you discover it yourself? Where were you when, where online were you when it popped up in front of you?
Amazon, search, right? I just typed in toothpaste and it was one of the top items that came up with my search results. Because they had good content, I was able to read and better understand the brand. I liked the packaging. I loved the natural message that they were having, that they weren't chemicals. And that's what really got me off the, off the sidelines and able to take a chance and buy it.
And were you searching for something new in toothpaste, or were you just trying to find some toothpaste to get? And then that just totally took you down that path.
Yeah, I was not searching for something new. I was searching for toothpaste. And I just used a generic, word toothpaste to search, expecting, Colgate to come up or Crest to come up. And Hello Toothpaste was doing a better job in terms of winning the buy box. And because they did that day, they were able to get me as a convert.
Plus, as we talked about before we went on the air, you have three children that are going through orthodonture in one stage or another. So I'm sure toothpaste is at the top of your list. How can I prevent spending more with the orthodontist?
Well, you're exactly right. But it's also, it's also the desire to try to put in front of them, all the best, the most natural products that are available. I mean, there's so much news nowadays about, lead pipes and chemicals in this. I mean, big news piece this morning about Zantac, with having, chemicals in the medicine and so forth and so on. And because I think, a lot of consumers are just going that extra mile to make sure that what they're buying and putting into their body is actually feeding or helping their body as opposed to, adding some type of a chemical to do something that's not natural.
Yeah, and it makes you less price sensitive, I would imagine.
Yes and no, but I mean, that's where the online shopping experience is a great equalizer. I mean, because you have clear price transparency, I don't believe I'm spending anything more for Hello Toothpaste than I am for, say, Colgate Toothpaste. Now, to be clear, I am laying out more cash per purchase because of how they're bundling things together. So I'm buying, a higher price for a larger bundle. But generally speaking, when you start doing the math, it all adds up to regular toothpaste, regular Walgreens in-store toothpaste cost.
Well, speaking of costs and online, if Hello is your favorite digitally native brand, what's your favorite private label brand?
That's a great question. I would say Kirkland. Right,
I'm a
fan of Costco.
Yeah.
Right,
Kirkland's
actually
kids.
One of the largest brands online. And their online execution isn't as good as it can be. So there's a lot of resellers that are out there reselling their brands as third party sellers on Amazon. But no, anything Kirkland is fantastic. And I think going to the heart of what we're going to talk about here too. When we start talking about private label versus brands. Right. Understand that the private label is nothing more than an extension of the brand of the retailer. So it actually is a brand. It's just a brand of a retailer. And when you put it into that context, you start understanding, what is the role or what does some brands, what some retailer brands, what role do they have in your life? Well, for me, you know, Costco always delight me, always delights me when I go there. I'm always able to find what I want or what I need. And I think that that brand promise being fulfilled every time I go there is one of the reasons why I really do enjoy the Kirkland brand so much, despite the category that it's in.
Totally. So today, the two major topics that we're going to cover are the two major threats to traditional market share of large brand manufacturers. And one is the digitally native upstarts. There's just feels like there's startups in every single category raising a ton of money from venture capital and eating market share, going direct to consumer, going through new routes to market. And the second is what seems like a rise in private label. Private label sales, I believe, are their highest ever as a percentage of market share. And both of these trends are acting against the traditional category captains across almost every single major category. So it, in that context, I wanted to start by going deep with private label and the digitally native brands in conjunction with each other on what the market share looks like. I mean, you, and with IRI's data, you've got a really amazing example of coffee. And like in store, you go down the coffee aisle at any grocery store and there's Folgers and there's, you know, just a handful of brands. But online, there's a whole bunch. So can you share what the coffee category in particular looks like? Because I think it's just an awesome example of what we're seeing across the rest of the categories.
Sure, absolutely. And before we get there real fast, let's make sure we understand the story. The reason that established category brand leaders within the in-store world, the Folgers, you know, the Starbucks, so forth and so on, the reason that they continue to do so well is believe it or not, is because the in-store environment is really a closed ecosystem. It's a closed ecosystem where very large corporate retailers operate with very large corporate branded organizations to really exclude out any type of a fringe or new type item. They do that because of how much money they're exchanging between each other, right? And in the form of fees, in the form of trade discounts, in the form of additional co-marketing programs, so forth and so on. These large corporate entities, some retailers, some brands, really work to really separate themselves from everyone else. Now, when you go to the online world, that barrier to entry really diminishes. And the number one catalyst of this has been the Amazon Marketplace. Because of the Amazon Marketplace, any one of us here on the line today can actually start a brand tomorrow and sell it tomorrow on Amazon. So that barrier has evaporated. So now more and more competition is coming in. What we've discovered, and let's start general, then we'll go coffee. What we discovered, if we take a look at the entire consumer packaged good industry, and we line up the top 80% of sales for the online world, we compare it to the top 80% of sales in the in-store world, what we quickly realize is that there's nearly three times as many brands online in that top 80% of sales than there are in store. So that's a representation of a substantial fragmentation of what consumers are buying. When you take it to the coffee category, which is a bit of an extreme example here, especially for a food category, the beverage category, well, what we find right now is that that number of brands online in the top 80% of sales versus the number of brands in the in-store environment in the top 80% of sales is 6.2 times greater online than it is in store. Again, it's an incredible amount of fragmentation of the marketplace that is really leading to this issue that many in-store category brand leaders are experiencing, which is a decline in share.
And do you feel like in coffee that's happening because there are so many coffee fanatics that want exactly their own buzz? You know, there's certain kind of coffee.
Yeah, it's high altitude, shane grown, hand picked.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's because these firms are doing an incredible job of segmenting the marketplace and finding these very specific consumer that wants what they're able to provide, or they're doing a better job of positioning what they have to those very specific consumers. And that's the big point here, guys. At the end of the day, it comes down to fantastic marketing, right? And that's where I truly believe that a lot of the core blue chip CPG firms right, with all their big titles and all the money that they have to spend when it comes to marketing, they've actually really let their shareholders down because they become less marketers and more business managers and making sure that they're able to deliver the number year after year, which is a very good thing. I'm not saying it's not a good thing. My point is that when they've been hyper-focused on cost and expense and then really trying to own this closed ecosystem between retailers and brand manufacturers, they've gotten away from being able to connect with consumers as well as some of these other firms have been able to connect with consumers.
And isn't it also that marketing online just requires so much more continuous attention and feels like a lot of these private brands, the digitally native ones, are coming in and they're sitting in front of their pages on every site every day, like tweaking constantly, right?
Owning of the business process versus owning of the marketing or owning of the customer is such an interesting way to go about it. But I think the large brands have been doing it a long time. My favorite story is the rise of Ben & Jerry's in the early 80s. So Ben & Jerry's was, an original niche brand going back decades ago. It was born and bred in Vermont. It had sort of like this hippie vibe to it. And it was gaining a lot of popularity in the Northeast. And they were trying to sign distribution agreements with grocers in the Northeast. At the time, Pillsbury, which has since been rolled up, but Pillsbury was a giant in that category. They owned Häagen-Dazs. I think Häagen-Dazs was the number one ice cream at the time. And Pillsbury went to their grocery partners and said, you know what, if you start carrying Ben & Jerry's, we're going to stop selling to you. Right, they really kind of dropped the hammer on it, and so they blocked Ben & Jerry's from being distributed in grocery stores. And what Ben & Jerry did was they actually went to Pillsbury's headquarters and they picketed it with signs that said, "What's the doughboy afraid of?" And they sold bumper stickers, "What's the doughboy afraid of?" And they had a national media campaign. It was on the news and people are covering it. And basically they shamed Pillsbury into relenting, and Ben & Jerry started getting distribution. And the rest is history. And of course, now Ben & Jerry's is part of Unilever. But like that's kind of how the large CPGs have been operating. Like they rolled up into these giant conglomerates that do so much business with the retailers that they can sort of keep competition.
They have all the power.
Yeah, they've got all the power. Now, like what Sam, what you're saying is online. That blockage doesn't exist. You can get to the consumer lots of different ways, and the new brands are kind of they're being creative about it, and the old brands are sort of scrambling a little bit to figure out exactly how to operate in that new environment. Is that about right?
You're exactly right, and there's a couple of things I would add to it. First and foremost, a lot of major brands they like to practice what I call set and forget, right? Because of these closed ecosystems, they're able to set up what they're doing for the next 12 months with a major retailer, and they sort of forget about it. Absolutely, they go back and they tweak things throughout the year. But it's really a set and forget type mentality versus when you go to the online world, it's an always on type mentality. Mm-hmm. You have to sit there and every single day you have to tweak. You have to learn what happened yesterday. You have to find the search terms that are being used right now by the consumers and make sure that you're as relevant as possible to that consumer. In addition to that, what they fail to understand, especially when it comes to new brands, the online space is ideal for new brands to flourish. What I mean by that, first and foremost, understand that most products are found via search bars, right? When you search, you're able to find what you need. So again, that goes back to owning the search terms that you need to own to make sure that you're being found. In addition to that, you have your own content. I used an example earlier today of how one of my favorite digitally native brands is Hello Toothpaste. Well, they became my brand because I stumbled upon them. I was able to engage in their content and understand what they were all about. I appreciated it. And then my eyes continued to go down the page and I found the reviews and I saw their star ratings. And then I was able to really better understand how I could interact with this product by what the reviews were telling me. In the in-store environment, you find a new item, all you have is the packaging. Maybe there's a sample nearby, right, in a Costco or some other retailer. But generally speaking, you're left with the packaging and you're making a decision. When you go online, you're left with the marketing material, the content. Right. You're also able to look at ratings and reviews. You look at the sales ranks as well, too, to see if other people are buying it. And then that allows you to make your decision with more confidence that this will or will not be something that I will like.
A lot of the major manufacturers, though, are gaining a bunch of these skills. Like I look at Tide as an example, and Procter & Gamble on Amazon has done, I think, a really nice job with Tide. I mean, they've got great images. Their product titles are optimized. And in that category, they're also setting a barrier to entry that maybe wasn't true 3 years ago by bidding up the advertising. Mm-hmm. And so they're winning all of the top ad spots for anything that has to do with detergent. And it shows in the market share. I mean, you shared some data where in store Tide has like 60.1% of the share, and on Amazon it's 53.1% of the share. That's the data that you had from IRI. But I think one of the things that I've seen you talk about in the past is that even if you're defending share, you're losing margin. Like that share defense comes at a cost, because you can't rely on simply blocking out the competitors to begin with. You have to pay to compete. You have to work at the reviews. You have to work at the SEO. You have to work at the advertising. Do you have any idea, like generally speaking, what the margin compression looks like when a brand is fighting hard like that?
That's a fantastic question, and getting right to the point. I mean, that margin compression will vary on the different manufacturers. I mean, what I found though, however, is, and there's two edges of this coin here too. The first thing is that when it comes to traditional blue chip manufacturer, because so much of their business is still in the in-store environment, they're sort of crushed in when it comes to margin, not because of all the new that they have to do online, right? Which you know, they'll be the first one to complain about how expensive it is, but also, you know, they're also having to do all the other stuff that's really expensive in the in-store environment too. So they're having to do both things. Versus if you're a digitally native brand, you don't have that liability of that in-store, right? Because that business doesn't exist for you. In addition to that, you don't have that liability of all those many years or many decades of optimizing your offer year after year, right? And expanding your margin year after year, right? So those newer companies don't have that history that holds them back. History in the form of A, all that optimization has happened for the last couple of decades. And then history B is that there's so much more volume in the in-store environment, they can't just walk away from it. That's why they're focusing on it. I'll be the first one to say, like, yes, online is very expensive, but there's a lot of things in the in-store environment that are also very expensive, just that firms are not willing to make the decision of, like, do I walk away from the in-store to focus on the online, or do I need to do both? And they always choose to do both, which is why it's costing more money today.
But Sam, at the same time, aren't we also seeing with the digitally native brands that they bump up to some sort of ceiling on their growth because they can't scale enough with just a digital offering? That, you know, you see so many of these brands opening up their own storefronts because they know they need that combination. Do you see that happening in grocery?
Well, what I would actually say, what we're seeing is that right now, and Hello Toothpaste is an example of this. Honest Brands is another example of this. This is where digitally native brands that start online are now coming to the in-store environment. And they are continuing to scale from online to in-store, right? And the number one reason that is happening is because they're connecting better with consumers, mm-hmm. right? You know, Rob, you talked about Ben & Jerry's ice cream. You know, and the one point that I want to point out about Ben & Jerry's ice cream is that people love Ben & Jerry's ice cream. This goes back to the marketing of it all. When you have a brand that someone loves, people will beat your door down or find a way to be able to always find your product. Price will be less, they'll be less price sensitive, and they'll be able to always find a way to connect with your product like that. What has happened in the general blue chip CPG firms is that many of these brands have become commoditized. Right? Where what's the difference between Clorox and Lysol? It's a bleach wipe, right? What's the difference between, you know, Clorox bleach and bleach? What's the difference between detergent and detergent? And that's sort of the point here, right? When you do a fantastic job of marketing, we do a fantastic job of really, you know, owning what it is about your brand that makes you special. No one else is able to own that.
So that answer really gets to the heart of brand equity, and brands these days really need to delight their consumers to rise above the veneer of being generic, right? And to really demand the high prices and margin defense and repeat buys and all that sort of stuff. And there's sort of two issues that come to mind for me. And I they're connected in my head, although they might not sound connected. One is there's this idea of the death of the mass market. Like 30 years ago in 1995, I guess that's not 30 years ago, but in 1995, there was top 40 radio and there was alternative rock and hip hop was coming up and looked like that was it, right? And nowadays, with Spotify and streaming, it's not that you know, you like dubstep, it's that you like Seattle dubstep or Chicago dubstep, or it really niches down to what you're interested in. And so you see a lot of these direct-to-consumer brands, they're not really mass market. They're really hitting small subsets of consumers to whom they can be exceptionally relevant and an exceptionally good fit. The other angle of this is that CPGs have turned, a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them have turned into operating machines that drive down costs and drive up profitability. And they haven't really invested that much in additional consumer delight and additional product. And you see that in the percentage of revenue that's spent in R&D for all the majors decreasing consistently every year for the last 30 years. So it's almost like they're, on the one hand, you've got direct-to-consumer brands hyper laser focused on delighting consumers. On the other hand, you've got the CPGs walking away from it a little bit. So in terms of brand equity, I mean, do you see both of those trends? Do you see them as related? Do you see them as continuing?
Yeah, absolutely, Rob. I mean, I see them as completely related. And unfortunately, until the industry changes, they will continue. See, the issue we have here is, to your point, the big blue chip CPG firms have really positioned themselves best to operate in a mass market world, right? Defining the mass market world, a world that is defined by Walmart, by Target, and by national grocery chains, whether here in the U.S. or abroad. And when you insert yourself into that situation, your number one consumer isn't necessarily the shoppers who are in store, but the buyer who is selecting whether or not you get on shelf. Right, so that getting on shelf hurdle really drives everything you do in the industry. And when you're faced with really only mattering to a few buyers in the industry as opposed to really the core shoppers, what happens here is that these firms are finding it very challenging for them to find either a large, big, high-value new items, high-value defined as plus 30 million, plus 50 million in year one, right? Or finding efficient activity that really drives sales, driving a superior return on investment. So what we have happened here is that these firms become flush with cash because they are so optimized over year on year. And then that cash, instead of going into R&D, instead of going into digital, instead of building out new direct-to-consumer capabilities or building out new businesses, that cash goes to their shareholder. There's a fact that we've been throwing around here at IRI. We did an analysis over the last decade plus, and the analysis was really trying to pull apart the financials of Amazon versus Walmart. As many of you know, Amazon, when it comes to the online space, they have an incredible lead right now versus everyone else in the industry. They have that lead because, as we all know, Jeff Bezos doesn't play the short game. Jeff Bezos played the game for where it's going to be 7 years from now as opposed to where it is today. And because of that, Jeff Bezos has been investing substantial sums of all the money that they make back into their core business. On the other hand, you look at Walmart. Now, Walmart has a many-decade history. Walmart has investors. Walmart has a history of paying dividends to their investors. Yes, they have that opportunity. But in addition to that, Walmart has been paying out over $60 billion in stock buyback during the same time frame. That is investment dollars that went to the shareholders and to senior management and didn't go into their core business for them to be able to drive their business. Now, that's a startling large number, but when you go to the brand side and you do the same analysis, you understand that U.S.-based CPG branded companies have spent well over $100 million doing the exact same thing during the same time period. So again, there is investment that is happening back into the investor community as opposed to into your product and into your go-to-market strategy.
But Sam, how many of those digitally native brands that are spending that much money are actually profitable versus being backed by venture money, which is in a way just an opposite side of a dangerous, you know, business practice? You know, what are you seeing out there? Do you feel like they are on their way towards profitability?
Yeah, well, I don't obviously have, you know, look into everyone's financials.
Yeah.
What I would say to you is that I understand right now in the current market, there is a higher premium being paid on growth as opposed to profitability, mm-hmm. right? You're seeing that in the Amazon numbers day in and day out. You're seeing it across the industry. So while these firms may not be as profitable, they are substantially growing. And at the end of the day, when you start understanding what is a brand's role, in a, whether it's a company or a investment portfolio, if you understand what the brand's role is, you will understand that some brands will have the role of driving growth, and some brands will be harvested in their role to drive profitability. So in that context, the blue chips right now are driving the profitability industry while their growth is very low. And the smaller brands, as they continue to connect with consumers in a superior way, they're driving the higher rate of growth right now.
So I look at a couple of the things that you said as, and I want to tie them together. So one thing is that a new brand is $30 to $50 million first year, right? The second thing that you said is that the CPGs have spent over $100 billion in stock buybacks in the last decade, which is just an astonishing number. And I wonder though, if we think about the trend from a mass market to this set of much smaller niche markets, whether those two things are also related, right? So if you're trying to build a Procter & Gamble today, instead of dozens of brands that were large and mass market and many of which are multi-billion dollar brands, to build P&G today to the same scale, would you need 800 brands that were all smaller? And would you be able to wring the same type of profitability off of that? And I got to imagine that if you're Unilever and you're P&G and you're these companies that are doing stock buybacks, you look at the picture and you say, geez, you know, it's just...
That's hard.
I'm going to return some money to my shareholders rather than to invest in a bunch of $10 million products.
That may or may not work. Yeah, it's a risk, right?
Yep. No, that's what the opportunity that the industry is facing right now. But what I would suggest to our industry, though, is that we try to take a page from what we're seeing from the technology or digital industry. And what I mean by that is that for the last 50 plus years, we've been optimizing to be able to better create, better produce, better ship products to few locations around the industry, i.e. stores, right? And that's how we've been optimized for the last 30 to 50 years. That's everything we do is based on that model. The model has now changed where each point of purchase right now is no longer in the in-store environment, but it's through your phone or through your desktop. So I do believe that there is an opportunity to find scale, not in production, not in shipping, not in all the back room. I think the scale that a firm needs to invest in is scale that allows them in a superior way to connect with the very specific consumers that matter for the specific offering that they have. So this is where you have to be hyper personalized. You have to be hyper targeted, and then you have to be able to delight at that one-on-one type need versus the mass market. Now, when you take a look at strategy, I always say this in many meetings that I'm in, strategy is not always what you choose to do, but also what you choose not to do. And what I mean by that is that there are product price points and niches that by default are much more profitable than some of the standard mass market niches that we've been really aligning to. And I think that's the best way to be profitable. And the one analogy I'll leave you with here is that when you take a look at some of the recent trends at some of the luxury brands in across the globe, many of those brands who are well managed, their profitability continues to increase, right? And their profitability is increasing, not because they're selling more, but because they're selling more to the right people. And that's the same strategy that I'm seeing right now with folks like Amazon too. I truly believe that Amazon's purchase of Whole Foods was as much of an opportunity for them to have an expiration into the in-store environment as it was for them to obtain very specific shoppers who are specifically shopping at a specific store right now and spending at a very certain price level. Retaining those shoppers or gaining those shoppers and then retaining those shoppers and then selling up to those shoppers, that really is what I believe is the future for the industry going forward.
Yeah, I just saw today in the news that Amazon Fresh, the $15 delivery charge has been dropped by Amazon, and it's now part of Prime.
That's a penetration play, on Amazon right now. They're trying to gain more and more penetration to get more and more folks onto their platform. And then once they have enough traffic on their platform, Amazon's able to do several things. First of all, they're able to better understand those shoppers so they can better target those shoppers. But also what they're able to do is that they're able to open up a second source of revenue, which is they can sell those shoppers to the different brands in the industry so that they are able to continue to drive, you know, revenue growth as well as profitability.
On a high note, though, if we look at advantages of the big CPGs, the distribution network that they've got actually is quite an advantage. And I think if they leverage it creatively, they can actually drive up margin as well. So from a, you know, and Sam, and what you were talking about being specifically targeted. So I think of one example, Coca-Cola was partnering with Kroger so that for click and collect, there could be an ice cold Coca-Cola available for you when you drive your car up to load your car. And that's a high margin individual item sale compared to the six pack that's in the beverage aisle, right? And you know, you think about beer sales, a six pack of beer in the grocery store, not that much profit off of that thing. One beer at Fenway Park, extremely profitable. And so the distribution and the location and the experience around the purchase, I think is an advantage that the big guys should wield more effectively than they've been wielding. You know, get out of the aisle, get somewhere else, charge higher prices. It's just hard to see the direct-to-consumer brands having the scale to be able to compete with strategies like that.
Right, and then your example is fantastic because, you know, again, you know, that Coke could be sold at a pretty good profit, but I would actually venture that Kroger, you know, might sell that as a loss as another example of Coke being a loss leader. And why? Well, because the role of Coke in that example is to bring more people into the click and collect business, into the buy online, pick up at store type business. And again, what you see here, though, the great example that you just laid out here is an example of a brand and a retail partner specifically understanding what the role is of that brand and capitalizing on that brand's role with when it comes to the shopper. And then they can decide whether or not they make it a profit driver, or they can decide whether or not they make it a traffic driver. But that's the understanding and the relation back to insight that we need to go to as an industry to understand what will work. And it's not, you have to move away from, I'm going to put out a six pack because Pepsi put out a six pack, right? No, I'm going to put out a highly differentiated ice cold Coke, right? Because I can own that like no one else can in the industry.
Yeah. So Sam, if you are and maybe this is a good way to close, but if you are the executive sitting in that executive suite, trying to understand the profitability of their products and how they should be investing in innovation while they're still doing all of the expensive stuff in brick and mortar and also adding digital spend onto it. And there's shareholder, you know, buybacks going on. How do you think about those trade-offs? How do you kind of make your choices in this environment?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it comes down to you have to decide. Again, you know, in my position in the industry right now, I have the incredible opportunity of working, you know, well over 130 different CPG firms, and then, you know, all the U.S.-based major retailers at the same time. And the biggest opportunity I see right now is that no one's willing to make a decision. And because they're not willing to make a decision, they keep doing what they have been doing. And in my guidance always here is that we understand how this story is going to be written. We understand that consumers are going to continue to want more convenience. They're going to continue to want more convenience, and they're going to be willing to pay for that convenience. And because you understand that, you need to start making hard decisions and start cutting off businesses or cutting off traditional budget allocations to businesses or to retailers or to brands that will not make it to the future. That's challenging, but you can do that when you have the right data. When you continue to use that data to get to the right insights, you continue to test and learn, it becomes self-evident on where you need to invest. The old saying here, using a hockey analogy, is that you need to be where the puck is going to be as opposed to where the puck is today. And that takes vision. It takes vision and it takes courage. And I think those are the two things that our industry needs most of right now.
Well, I don't think there's much more to be said than that. I mean, to me, that is the call to arms of this environment that we're in. And I think to your point, Sam, the opportunity is enormous. If you think of fulfilling on those expectations of the consumer, you can drive the success of your business in a really aggressive way. But to your point, you need to cut away the dead parts that might be painful, but then move forward with this fresh look. I think that makes a ton of sense.
Cut away the dead parts is what you want to end with here.
All right, let me restate that. Actually, yeah, no, yeah. You're exactly right, Sam. Sean, can you make something of that? Sam, I think that call to arms is exactly the way to close out the podcast, because I think for everyone that's listening and trying to figure out this path in front of us, the opportunities are enormous. And I think it does take, as you said, sort of the data, the intelligence, and the courage, the guts to make those calls. It's not easy to do, but the rewards could be big. So, Sam, thank you so much for... go ahead.
Yeah, no worries. One last thing I would say, if you want to continue this, you know, there's almost more reward for not being wrong than there is for being right in our industry right now. And I would challenge everyone to lean forward and try to be right more often. And let's all not try not to be wrong.
And Sam, is there a way to do that? Can you pilot something like that? Or is it really sort of, all right, you're all in or you're all out? Like, is there a way for companies to do that? Or is that part of the problem that they're doing this at the margins and it's not really enough to prove that it's working?
Yeah, I think there absolutely is. There's a big way to do it. First of all, understand when it comes online, it never really ever costs too much. Additionally, you never need to think that whatever you do online is only limited to exposure online. You know, we know that most purchases begin in store from what people saw online. So you need to expand the way that you're thinking of the path to purchase in that context. Finally, you know, it doesn't cost a whole lot, but you just need to start planting a lot of different tests out there and see which ones really bubble up. Right now is the time to do it because it doesn't cost that much. The scale still isn't that large, and you'll be able to gain a lot of benefit from it. And then the very last thing here that I would add, even though I just said finally a moment ago, the one thing I would add here is that don't let your current organizational structure or way you've been doing things dictate to how you need to do things. Again, that's another example of how we continue to see some of the smaller firms who don't have the legacy budgets, the legacy or structure or the legacy supply chain. They're moving quicker because they're not, you know, dealing with their structure that they have today. They're just allocating resources to where they're seeing the opportunities. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would encourage, you know, all firms to be able to start maneuvering in that context.
Great, Sam. Thank you. We appreciated all the finales that you gave us. And really, thank you so much for joining us on the program and sharing your insights. It's been incredibly entertaining and also very valuable.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed it.
That's all the big data we have for today. What's your path forward? Have some questions for Sam? Come to the Digital Shelf Institute's LinkedIn page or tweet at us at WinDigitalShelf. Please drop a review of our podcast when you have a chance. And thanks for being part of our community.